8. Toughening up. Ron and I considered it a point of pride that we could deliver the emotional truth in our performances and bring genuine tears. Dad taught us that other people might need to fake it, but not the Howards. Glycerin? We didn't need no stinking glycerin. It became an us-against-them challenge. When I saw adult actors sit still while the makeup artist painted streaks of glycerin on their faces, I thought, these people, they don't know what they're doing. In my youthful bravado and arrogance, I considered their approach lazy. In 1972, I landed a lead role in a TV movie called The Red Pony, adapted from a John Steinbeck novella. The film contains what I consider my best childhood work, not least because, using Dad's by then time-tested mini methodology, I summoned a whole lot of tears and anger. In The Red Pony, I played a Depression-era farm boy who is entrusted with the horse of the title, a colt. The colt catches a respiratory disease known as the strangles. I fall asleep in the barn while keeping watch over him, and he runs away. By the time I find him, my colt has collapsed in a stream, and a bunch of buzzards have descended on him, pecking away at his lifeless body. I'm still very proud of how nuanced and expressive I was in conveying my character's grief, yearning, and self-disgust at letting his horse spring free. But the film also occasioned one of the most traumatic episodes of my life. Its director, Robert Totten, was a family friend and a significant figure in the Howard family's lives. More on him later. As we set up by the stream, Bob announced that he wanted me to pick up one of the buzzards in anger and smash him to death on a rock. Not a prop buzzard, a real one. This would never, ever be allowed on a film set today, but the ethical mores of the 1970s were different. Nevertheless, killing a bird did not sit well with me. I had worked with animals for the better part of my young life. My co-star in Gentle Ben was a bear, for Christ's sake. I made my feelings known to Bob. He told me to man up and just do the deed. The bird is going to take one for the team, he said. Dad reassured me that a natural predator would likely eat the buzzard anyway. We had an animal welfare guy on location with us, and I still can't imagine how this was sanctioned. I was already worked up about the emotional aspect of the scene, as it was a climactic moment for my character. Now I also had to execute a bird, and in a single take, so that I didn't have to murder more than one. Bob called action, and everyone's eyes were on me. He staged this scene, so there was a conveniently protruding flat rock right where I stood in the stream. I picked up the buzzard by its legs and whacked its head on the rock. Mercifully, it only took a few whacks for the bird to die. You can watch the scene and see for yourself, but I can't. It's too painful. In what was otherwise the high watermark of my juvenile career, that experience scarred my psyche. As Ron has said, we were privileged to be treated respectfully as peers of our adult colleagues in the workplace. Occasionally, though, adults lost sight of our sensitivity and innocence. We were precocious and talented, but still very much children. Most of the time, fortunately, Mom and Dad zealously protected us from the dark and predatory aspects of the business. A lot of child actors weren't as fortunate. Their own parents were the predators, withholding affection and frittering away their kids' earnings. Our folks were scrupulously honest about money. In the 60s, as Ron worked on Andy Griffith, and I had episodic work on such shows as The Fugitive, Please Don't Eat the Daisies, and The Virginian, we brought home some serious paychecks. Even so, Mom and Dad never lived outside their means. Let me emphasize, their means. As soon as we can understand, Dad explained to Ron and me what was happening to the money we earned. By state law, 15% of our earnings were automatically placed in a Coogan Trust account, whose funds could not be accessed by anyone but us when we turned 18. These accounts were named for Jackie Coogan, not to be confused with Jackie Cooper, the child actor who had starred opposite Charlie Chaplin in The Kid and made boatloads of money in the 1920s, only to discover at the age of 21 that his fortune had been squandered by his parents. In the aftermath of Coogan's successful lawsuit against his mother, the the state of California passed the Child Actors Bill, which most people in the industry referred to as the Coogan Law. As for our remaining earnings, Mom and Dad put every penny into savings accounts and U.S. bonds in our names, apart from a 5% manager's fee that they drew for looking after our careers. That's a bargain. Most managers charge triple that amount. Much later on, Dad explained his reasoning to Ron and me. He said that if we kids had ever gotten the idea that we were the household's breadwinners, it would have messed up the family dynamic. With Mom's help, he was making just enough as an actor and part-time manager to support the four of us. Preserving a sense of normalcy was a top priority for Dad. In 1963, we moved from Hollywood back to Burbank, where Mom and Dad became homeowners for the first time. 346 North Cordova Street was a small tract house just a half a block from our old apartment. 3 bedrooms, 1 bathroom, and best of all, in my view, a pool. Boy, I loved to splash around in that pool. Ron and I shared a bedroom, and Dad used the spare as his office. When the family car, the 52 Plymouth Cranbrook, finally gave out, Dad gave no thought to a Jag or a Mercedes. He splurged on a new car for the first time in his life, but it was a red Chevy Nova Super Sport in candy apple red. Dad was proud to own a new car, and even prouder that he paid for it in cash. Somewhere along the way, Mom got a new car too, a big, bulky Plymouth whose yellow body was pocked with parking lot dings within a few months of it being in her possession. She was a solid driver, but the other Burbank moms who frequented the local supermarkets were not. We rarely went on vacation, busy as we all were with work. When we did, our trips were austere affairs. One of our reliable destinations was the Apple Valley Inn, located in the high desert 100 miles from Burbank. The resort was run by Roy Rogers, who tried to do for Apple Valley what Bob Hope and Frank Sinatra had done for Palm Springs. It never quite took. Maybe the cold 30-mile-per-hour nighttime winds were too much for the Rat Pack. But Dad loved the inn's western kitsch, the decorative wagon wheels, and wood paneling. He was in his element, and his happiness at Apple Valley was contagious. Cordova Street was nevertheless a big step up for us. Within a few blocks stood the entire world that Ron and I occupied when we weren't working and just being kids. 2 blocks away was Robert Louis Stevenson Elementary School, a campus of low post-war buildings and wide-open asphalt and grass playgrounds. You name it, we played it at recess. Softball, basketball, kickball, dodgeball. I never understood the appeal of dodgeball. It seemed unnecessarily cruel, with some poor kid, usually a nerd, getting whacked in the face with the ball. A few blocks past Stevenson was a public parks and recreation center, Verdugo Park, which had a gym where Ron shot baskets at every opportunity. I still live a few minutes away from the site of our ancestral pile. With the exception of our house, which has since been torn down and replaced with the McMansion, very little has changed. Mom didn't really like to cook, though we did eat at home most of the time. Meatloaf, ham, hamburgers, hot dogs, and fish sticks were regulars in her rotation of entrees. The vegetables came out of a can, though Mom, to her credit, knew how to whip up some tasty mashed potatoes. Mac and cheese was a side dish almost every night. It's amazing that Dad kept his weight at a consistent 173 pounds, a number he proudly reported to us whenever he stepped off the scale. We also dined out a fair amount, too. The local Sizzler, part of a chain that had only been founded a few years earlier in Culver City, was a go-to spot. Once in a while, we went to the King's Arms, a medieval-themed luxury restaurant where there was a sword set in stone by the front entrance. Ron and I drank Shirley Temples there. Between the sugar high from those, the cartoons that I had seen about King Arthur's court, and the old English interior decor, I was often motivated to make a dramatic scene of trying to pull that sword out for laughs. My fondest early memory of brotherhood is of jumping out of bed before Mom and Dad were up to join Ron in the hallway, where he lay stretched out near the wall heater, absorbing the Los Angeles Times sports section. After our dog Gulliver died, Mom and Dad got us a cat, who we named Mitts because he had an extra pinky claw that made him look like he was wearing a catcher's mitt. Ron woke up early to feed Mitts. After that, he brought the newspaper in. I liked to climb onto Ron's back as he studied the box scores aloud and recounted the highlights from the Dodgers game. Snugly in place atop my big brother, my blonde head peering out over his red head, I listened intently as he narrated to me what Don Drysdale, Maury Wills, Tommy Davis, and his beloved Sandy Koufax had done the night before. There was no safer feeling. The warmth of that heater, the softness of our PJs, the encouraging voice of my brother as he taught me how the game worked.
I loved that sensation of Clint's weight on my back and of having someone to evangelize to about my beloved Dodgers. Dad was athletic, but never cared much for team sports, being a product of the Lonesome Prairie. His things were boxing, wrestling, and horseback riding. I was so successful at explaining batting averages and other baseball statistics to Clint that the teachers at Stevenson Elementary believed that he was a math prodigy. He was bringing some of my lessons into the classroom at kindergarten level. Someone from the school called my parents and said, "He doesn't just know his numbers, he understands the concepts of multiplication, division, and percentages." The school thought it had a legit math genius on its hands, a Goodwill Hunting situation. They put Clint in some advanced classes, but then he sort of leveled off in terms of proficiency, and it was deduced, finally, that his facility for reciting baseball stats had created a misimpression. Still, Clint had a sharp mind. As he evolved from the hee-hee man into my walking, talking roomie, I began to appreciate him as a person. He was funny and irreverent in a way that I wasn't. As we lay in our beds, we both cracked up at his droll little observations about Dad's efforts to cover up his thinning hair, the comb-overs, and the foggy applications of hold-it-in-place hairspray that drove Mom crazy. Of course, karma would get back at us in a big way. Early in my Happy Days era, I noted the amount of red hair that was damming up the drain when I showered. I then contemplated the hairlines of every male I had met on both sides of our family and humbly accepted my fate right then and there. Clint was also highly coordinated for his age, good enough to play reasonably competitive games of Nerf basketball and wiffle ball when we were still little. We also wrestled, as brothers do, or wrestled, because that's how Dad said it in his otherwise faint Oklahoma accent. One of our bonding rituals was watching pro wrestling matches on Channel 5, a local station. We couldn't get enough of it. The flamboyant heels, Freddie Blassie and Gorilla Monsoon, the pretty boys, Buddy Rogers and John Tolis, the abnormally huge Haystacks Calhoun. Like lots of kids, Clint and I couldn't quite suss out if the violence was real. It looked real, but something about it felt a bit theatrical. Whatever it was, we loved it. Clint and I imitated the pro wrestlers, tackling each other to the floor. Sometimes when I was pissed off at him for knocking down a Lincoln log house I'd made or telling on me like a whiny little bastard, our fights turned real. I had a major physical advantage being 5 years older, and I would pin Clint to the floor, my face flushed with anger and vengeance, and he would scream, "Mom!" It was always Dad who ran in and separated us. He had a stock speech that he gave us whenever this happened. "One of these days, you boys are going to be grown men, living in different places, and you're going to wish that you were friends. I hope you really cherish what you've got, because you are brothers, but you have a chance to also be lifelong friends. And that starts now." It was a good cool-down speech, but I realized that it was also rooted in a kind of regret. He and his brother Max had an 11-year age difference and were not close. He didn't want history to repeat itself.
The truth is, Dad loved wrestling as much as we did. He initiated the action by declaring, "Come on, boys, let's do some wrestling." We'd move the furniture to prepare the ring, though this didn't always assure us safety. Doesn't every boy remember cracking his head on the sofa? Then Dad would drop to his knees and do his best version of a ring announcer and introduce us as wrestlers, just like the guy did on Channel 5. He really turned it on for these matches, putting to use his skills as a former children's thespian. "Ding, ding, ding," he'd announce. "And now, the main event." I would grab a hold of his legs, and he would humor me by falling to the floor. One of the reasons I made fun of Dad's hair loss was that his newly exposed forehead scrunched into these big lateral wrinkles when he was on the floor, and the sight of his head upside down was hilarious to me. A reconfigured face. The wrinkles looked like a mouth, and his eyebrows were like a weird mustache. And, well, you know, it's the kind of thing a kid gets obsessed with. Dad always let us win. He played the defeated guy really well, groaning, "Arr! Oh, you got me again!" And then he switched to the announcer, doing the count and raising the victor's arm. As Ron and I got deeper into pro wrestling, I took a liking to the greatest heel of them all, the Sheik. To simulate the head wrap he wore, I pulled a pair of my own tighty-whities over my head, the elastic at my temples. God, I hope they were clean.
My devotion to pro wrestling was put to the test when I took my first trip to Canada, the summer after the Andy Griffith Show's second season. Andy and Don were making good money during the show's hiatus by performing a variety act at carnivals and state fairs. With the Music Man compounding my fame, they invited me to join them for a two-week stint doing shows in the province of Ontario. Dad came along, and while it was initially frightening to perform before large crowds, some as big as 20,000 people, I got over it fast and found it to be pretty easy work. We'd perform some sketches in character from our TV show, and then Andy would say, "You're not just Opie, Ronnie. You're also Winthrop in The Music Man. Give us a song." I would sing Gary, Indiana with the exaggerated lisp and bring the house down. There were also old-time carny attractions, like a so-called Wolfman, who was just a sweaty guy with an inordinate amount of hair on his face, and a Wall of Death, which was a large, barrel-shaped structure in which daredevil motorcyclists rode around in circles, defying gravity thanks to friction and centrifugal force. One of our obligations was an appearance at a local daytime talk show in Toronto. While Andy, Don, Dad, and I were at the TV station, we were offered a tour. In an adjacent studio, we saw a setup for televised wrestling. It looked much smaller in person than it did on TV, with only three rows on each side for fans, though careful framing made the audience look much bigger. That was a little underwhelming and surprising, but what really opened my eyes was the sight I caught of two wrestlers in the hallway working out their routine. These weren't fit young Adonises. They were doughy guys who were long in the tooth, though nevertheless wearing only wrestling shoes and the brief Speedo-like trunks that wrestlers wore back then. Both men had cigarettes dangling from their lips. One had the other in a headlock and said, "And then you reach up and do a reverse." They practiced their moves a few times, the headlock followed by the counterattack. As I watched this, my heart sank. Does this mean that pro wrestling is fake? I tugged at my dad's sleeve and asked him to explain what was going on. Sensing my disillusionment, he gently said, "They really make their moves, and they really get hurt. But they're more like stuntmen than boxers." I couldn't wait to reveal this discovery to my friends back in Burbank. But it troubled me. In a neat feat of mental gymnastics, I convinced both my friends and myself that pro wrestling was fake only in Canada. In America, a championship belt was real, earned fair and square.
There was something else to Dad's roughhousing, his playful physicality with us. For one thing, we didn't just wrestle. He also taught us some of the fighting techniques that he had picked up in his amateur boxing days. Dad felt it was important that we be able to defend ourselves. I remember shadow boxing with him, that long left arm of his coming into my face for a pretend jab, with Dad shouting, "Double up! Double up! Bam, bam! Break his nose, Clint! Break his nose! What went unspoken, though Ron and I figured it out, is that Dad knew that we would be perceived as different, being show business kids. Our lives had a different shape than those of our peers, and he didn't want us to live in fear or be intimidated by anyone or anything. He wanted us to be ready.
Dad was right to be concerned. Because of my time away filming The Music Man, I entered the second grade not having been at Stevenson Elementary since kindergarten. Back then, I wasn't yet on The Andy Griffith Show, but now I was. And seemingly everyone in the world watched it. Certainly every kid at Stevenson did. And they all figured out that Opie rhymes with dopey, mopey, and soapy. I joined Stevenson's second grade when it was already in progress, so there was automatically that pressure of being the new kid, feeling every pair of eyes following you everywhere you went. In my case, this pressure was compounded by being recognized as the kid from TV. I could see it plain as day. My classmates were leaning into each other conspiratorially, mouthing, "Opie." This sort of thing would dog me throughout my childhood, up to and including my high school years. I mean, to this day, people recognize me and call me Opie, and that's fine. I'm happy to be remembered in that way. But as a schoolboy, there was a malevolence to the way I was singled out. I found it demeaning and insulting when I got "Hey, Opied," because there was an assumption that went with that, that I was wimpy and cosseted, or that I was a braggart and a show-off, or when I was older that I must be a rich dickhead with a fancy car, throwing money around, trying to buy friends. My rebellion was to be none of those things, which, by the way, didn't take much effort. More about that later. But back to second grade, the time of my first experience with the downside of celebrity. What I felt primarily at that time was not anger, but fear. Not so much of physical danger, though there was an undercurrent of that. Mostly, I feared the embarrassment of being singled out and picked on. And I was confused and disoriented by the fact that an aspect of my life that I loved, being a part of productions like The Andy Griffith Show and The Music Man, was the reason I was singled out. My first week back at school, I didn't feel safe going to the bathroom. The one time I did, I was harassed and hassled by the bigger boys while I stood at the urinal. But I didn't want to complain to my teachers or the principal. That would make me a snitch. So I decided one day that I simply wouldn't use the bathroom at school. I held it in all morning. I held it in during lunch break. I held it in that afternoon, staring at the clock, waiting for the 2:45 dismissal bell, trying desperately to hold off the stream. Until with just a minute or two to go, I could hold it no longer. I peed in my pants, soaking a whole pant leg. A few kids saw it happen and laughed at me. I ran home, humiliated. I told my parents how miserable I was feeling. They heard me out and came back with a plan. First, Mom and Dad said they hoped and predicted that things would settle down if I just hung in there and allowed the novelty of being the kid from TV to wear off. But if I was still unhappy at the end of the school year, they would enroll me in a smaller private school tailored to child performers. Sure enough, by the time the school year ended and my folks checked in with me about whether or not I wanted to leave Stevenson, I made it emphatically clear that I wanted to stay. Their parental wisdom had borne itself out. But it was a rough path to assimilating into the general student population. For a few weeks, I was a marked man at Stevenson. The encounters usually began with a snide, "Hey, Opie." Then there would be an escalation to shoving, with other kids gathering around to watch, point fingers, and laugh at me. Then my tormentor, whoever he was that day, would say, "Do you want to fight?" I didn't think it was acceptable to back down, so I said, "Yeah." And here's where the wrestling and sparring lessons at home with Dad came in handy. After school, my challenger and I would meet on the corner where I lived, Cordova and Oak. We'd start in the standing position, shoving and pushing. Then one of us would latch onto the other. We'd fall to the ground, and it basically became a wrestling match. This scenario unfolded with distressing regularity in second grade, more distressingly to my mom, who looked on in horror through the front window. My training allowed me to hold my own, usually getting the other kid in a headlock or a scissor lock before we called a truce. My challenger would pick himself up, dust himself off, and say something along the lines of, "You're a dead man, Opie," and skulk home. Dad never intervened in my front lawn scuffles, though he saw them from the same vantage point as Mom. He'd done a lot of fighting as a farm boy, and his attitude, as he said to Mom, was, "Let him fight it out." He saw this as a boyhood rite of passage. If blood had been drawn, it would have been different, but to Dad, these scraps were just ritualistic displays of elementary school preening. I even had the occasion to fight in defense of someone else. I was the third smallest kid in my grade. The smallest was a boy named Shep. One day, Shep was getting picked on by one of the tallest boys, who I'll call Jimbo. I said, "Jimbo, leave Shep alone." You know how it goes from here. "Yeah, what you gonna do about it, Opie?" We squared up. The Ronnie versus Jimbo match was one for the ages. Well, not really, but it was a triumph for me because I used my wiles to take him down with a scissor lock pin. For good measure, I started rubbing his crew-cutted head in the grass back and forth, giving his noggin a Dutch rub with my knuckles, just like Dad had taught me. Jimbo cried uncle. More importantly, he started acting more kindly towards Shep. And later on, he and I became friends. Still, I can't say I had a satisfactory relationship with violence. It proved a dead end. A few years later, around fifth or sixth grade, there was a new boy. I'll call him Skip, who had the look and affect of a 1950s hoodlum. Short blonde hair done up in a proto-Fonzie ducktail. Eyes that were always squinted into slits like he was looking at you with contempt. I was riding my skateboard on his side of the street one day. We exchanged words, one thing led to another, and this time I was the one who squared up and said, "Do you want to fight?" Skip gladly accepted. He came out with two left jabs to the right side of my face and a right cross to my left cheek. He knocked me right on my ass. I dusted off my pants, got on my skateboard, and rolled home unsteadily, rattled and embarrassed. That's the last time I ever challenged anybody to a fight. Fortunately, Skip was not long for Burbank and moved away. Playing the tough guy was not going to solve my self-confidence issues. One day in second grade, an alternative presented itself. We were doing a play in class, not a class play for the whole school, just a drama exercise as part of our reading curriculum, where we broke into smaller groups and performed little skits. My group was sitting in a circle, reading the dialogue aloud. Our skit was about a birthday party. The read-through wasn't going well. The girl next to me was struggling with her lines, with no sense of what they meant or what the scene was about. So I explained it to her. Then I asked the teacher if we'd be getting a real cake for the proper performance of the skit in front of the whole class. She said no, it was going to be all pretend. At that point, I couldn't help myself. My Andy Griffith Show training kicked in, and like a mini Bob Sweeney, I asked everyone to hop to their feet so we could block out the scene, choreographing our movements. I had the other kids putting on pretend party hats, blowing out make-believe candles and using imaginary forks. My teacher recognized what was going on, and rather than rebuke me for bigfooting her, she indulged me. I sensed that she knew I was struggling as the new kid and the TV kid, and she granted me this latitude to give me the chance to build my confidence. It worked. Our performance before the whole class was a hit. And that day marked the first time that I felt I had something to offer the other kids, something that they appreciated. I started feeling better about myself. Wow, I thought, as I put the other kids through their paces, I'm directing. One kid in particular, a new boy from Alaska and a fellow redhead, his name was Don, I believe, was seriously good at acting. The pro in me allowed the thought to cross my mind. If this Don kid wanted to get into the business, he has the goods. The rest of the kids were terrible actors, but I wisely kept that thought to myself. Before long, I had my own posse of buddies. One nice thing about Cordova Street is that the lots were only 50 feet wide, so each block was packed with families whose kids were the same ages as Clint and me. Three second-grade boys who lived on Cordova, Noel Salvatore, Bob Weems, and John Matthews, became my best friends, with whom I bonded over our mutual love of baseball and basketball. Sports was another great social equalizer. I'm still close to Noel, Bob, and John. Every year around Christmas, we reunite for a Cordova Street Boys dinner at the Smokehouse, the swankiest joint in Burbank. In our adulthood, I found out from Bob that during my early struggles at Stevenson, my mom, who was close to his, had approached Mrs. Weems to see if Bob might consider getting into acting. Mom offered to help set up Bob with an agent and walk Mrs. Weems through the ins and outs of being a child actor's parent. But Bob's mom shut the idea down, not wanting that life for her son. Mom was just trying to give me a comrade in arms, a friend who understood what I was going through. Fortunately, such extreme measures proved unnecessary. My friends were there for me as I returned to Stevenson from the Andy Griffith Show every February after our season had wrapped. And mind you, I needed them to be there. Every year, not just at Stevenson, but also at David Starr Jordan Middle School and John Burroughs High School, I would still be put through some sort of gauntlet, some sort of teasing and bullying by a group of kids who wanted to test me. What's bizarre when I think back upon it is that my time in front of the camera is what gave me the confidence to get through the social trials of my childhood years. In Mayberry, as Opie, I was at ease. It was away from stages 1 and 2 of Desilu Kawanga that I had to prove my value and self-worth, which is crazy. The tenuous, competitive, and often merciless world of show business was actually a safer space for me than the familiar hallways and playgrounds that the rest of my generation was inhabiting. This paradox is the crux of why so many successful child actors struggle in their adult lives.